Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, which this week takes a look at the lives of some famous people and the talented people who write about and photograph them. We'll also investigate how manipulating light can change your view of the world for the better and catch up with some artists doing riveting things in exhibition spaces. In this edition, the niece of film superstar Richard Burton talks about his family life and a biography of his life co-written with her father David Jenkins, Richard Burton's older brother. We drop in on artist Ian Walter at 10 Green Street and encounter political art that attacks the sexist nature of public statues. Renowned photographer Boleslaw Lutosławski gives us a glimpse of what makes his iconic photographic portraits of Europe's most famous arts figures so special. We sample the second Illuminate Festival as it lights up city landmarks using light technology in new ways with artworks carrying energy-saving messages. And painter Peter Hawksby talks on his work with changing spaces in Norfolk Street. You'll no doubt remember your own personal favourite moments in the career of film superstar Richard Burton as one of the greatest acting talents ever to hit the stage and silver screen, be it in John le Carré's The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, or Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Look Back in Anger, or perhaps a Tits and Toga epic. There's really no one who could match him for gem-cutting vocal precision, dramatic range, and intelligent British masculinity, and combined with Elizabeth Taylor, unforgettable sexual chemistry. His formidable Shakespeare performances, playing an unrivalled Hamlet, or at times even alternating nightly playing the roles of Iago and then Othello, are a matter of theatrical legend. But there's another side to Richard Burton's life that's less well known, and it's quite amazing to find out about it in the tight-knit world of the Cambridge bubble. Richard Burton's niece, Sue Rogers, kindly took time out with Arts Roundup to reflect on her uncle's extraordinary life from the perspective of his brother David Jenkins and Richard's Welsh family.
Sue, it's amazing what you find out in Cambridge, isn't it? We've known each other some time, and I had absolutely no idea that you are, in fact, the niece of the most fantastic film star of all time, Richard Burton. That must be quite a thing to have in the family.
Yes, I suppose I grew up with it. I can't remember a time when we didn't have Uncle Rich in the family, where I didn't have a famous uncle. So it wasn't something that... I don't remember the point when I discovered this. It was always thus. Even in the early 50s, he was well known. He started to make films. Obviously, he'd been a stage actor before that. He was always there.
His family life is something that you don't hear a huge amount about. I was a piece on the books the other day with Elizabeth Taylor giving an interview and saying how much they enjoyed the time that they could actually get away from all the glitz and spend quality time with their family. When did you first kind of get to know him as an uncle? Were you very young at the time?
I'm not sure I ever really got to know him. He used to come and visit us, and it was always a big event, and the neighbours were always very interested in these visits. We didn't really get close, because he was never there for long enough. The one time when I did get close to him was the only time, actually, that I spent any length of time with him, which is when they were making The Taming of the Shrew in 1966. I was 16, and we had been supposed to go on holiday to Switzerland, but my mother was ill, so we had to cancel that, and then there was a family funeral, and Richard, we used to call him Uncle Rich, they called him Rich, the brothers and sisters, came over and he said, couldn't go to Switzerland, that's a real shame, come out to Rome, come and stay with us. So we spent 2 weeks in Rome with Richard and Elizabeth and with her children, her three children and their joint adopted daughter Maria. So we did have a bit of a taste of what family life was like for them then, and that was the closest I think I ever got to him.
And did you get on with Elizabeth Taylor's children? What were they like?
Yeah, they were younger. Michael and Philip. Michael and Philip were the sons of Michael Wilding. They were about 12 and 10 or something. And Liza Todd, the daughter of Mike Todd, was 9. Mike Todd died tragically in a plane crash. And otherwise, I'm not sure she would have had so many husbands after that if he'd lived, but that's just my fantasy, perhaps. I don't know. And then Maria was adopted. She had been in an orphanage and she had had a serious disfigurement, but they paid for this to be put right, and she became a dancer, so that was a wonderful sort of happy ending story. So there we were with the family.
I've been reading your biography of Richard Burton's life and from the point of view of your father, David Chang, and you basically brought it together by writing it. A fantastically interesting story which basically tells what Richard was like from boyhood. One thing that I'd like to clear up immediately is, what is lava bread? Because I gather that Richard Burton and your whole family ate lava bread for breakfast, and it was described as Welsh caviar. What is it exactly?
Right, it's made from seaweed. I would have needed to prepare this because I'm not an expert on lava bread, but it is quite a speciality. And in the part of Wales that I grew up in, there was a tradition of the women from Penclawdd walking the 5 miles to Swansea to take the lava bread to market. So it was a very special dish. And yes, Richard enjoyed lava bread.
Now, you gave an account, a fantastic account in the book of his childhood in a Welsh valley. And he had quite an extraordinary childhood, didn't he, really? Because he was somebody who, the town was called Pontrydyfen. Basically, he was someone who very quickly learned to use his talents from reading the scriptures and doing things in church. How did he begin doing that in the first place?
Well, I don't know enough detail about that. He certainly enjoyed performing, and he used to go to chapel. I mean, I think the crucial thing about his childhood, of course, is that his mother died when he was 2, and so there were lots of children in the family. There were 13 altogether, although 2 died in infancy, so there were 11. He was the 10th, and you can imagine the absolute horror of losing their mother. So he went to live with the oldest sister, my auntie Sis.
And Sis, he had a great attachment to, didn't he? Because she kind of, in some ways, replaced your mother in his life, didn't he?
Yes, completely. She became his mother. But she had only just got married. I'm not really answering your question about the chapel, but I think I'm just going over onto things that I know a bit more about. I mean, certainly I do recall talking.
Were you a religious family? Your father was a policeman. David Jenkins, Richard's brother, was a policeman. And you came from a middle-class family. You were all well-educated by the sounds of it.
It was a working-class family. Yeah. I mean, my grandparents were very much working-class. My grandfather, Richard, and everyone's dad, was a miner. And my grandmother had been a barmaid, and I think that's how they met. So, educated.
He was someone who read avidly.
Yes, he did. He was very literary,
Very literary and very bright. And that basically fueled his dramatic skills, because he read all the way through his life, didn't he? He was a very intellectual person, really, in many ways.
And he was a great storyteller.
His career was very much set up by his school teachers, wasn't it? Because they encouraged him.
One school teacher in particular.
Yeah. Philip Burton,
in his name.
And he took Philip Burton's name by deepole as a stage name, didn't he?
He did, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the things that he used to do? Because as well as being someone who read the scriptures, went to chapel and read avidly, he also got into lots of trouble as well, didn't he?
He did get into trouble, yes. He was a bit of a troublemaker, and he was very popular with the girls. My auntie Sis used to talk about queues of girls coming to the house to see if he was there, to wait for him. She got rather indignant sometimes because she thought he treated them rather badly. But, he was a very good-looking young man, and he was very popular.
Now, he took some time out from school as a boy and became...
He went to work in the co-op.
Went to work... I thought he was a draper's assistant.
But it was part of the co-op.
Yeah. Yes, and during that time, he was somebody who was very much someone who got into rugby and drinking and smoking. And then he kind of...
So I'm not sure about the drinking and smoking as young as that. And it probably started later.
And then he was kind of, he went back to school after that, didn't he?
He went back to school, yes, because obviously times were hard financially. My auntie Sis, who effectively brought him up, got married, and they had 2 daughters of their own, and it wasn't easy. So This is a delicate matter because nobody really wanted him to leave school, but leave school he did. And then, I can't remember the details, I'm sure it's all in the book, but it was arranged that he went back to school and that he actually moved in to live with this English teacher, Philip Burton, for a time, who really schooled him and trained him.
And those two elements, basically, a partly misspent youth and a good education and a good teacher to set up, is the perfect foundation for an acting career, isn't
well,
it, really?
I suppose you could
because
say
it
that,
gives them
yes.
someone broad experience as yes. well as the education to take on roles like Hamlet, which, of course, brought him incredible acclaim and the attention of some of the most famous people in society
yes.
at the time.
Yes.
And Philip Burton was the catalyst to all of that, wasn't he?
Yeah,
yeah. And his first role was... He took on various small play roles in Talbot School, and he was recognised very early on as someone with an absolutely extraordinary talent, wasn't he?
Yes, There's one moment that really stands out in my memory where I think it was... He was taking part in some play. I can't even remember the name of the play, but he just had to sweep the floor. I don't think he had any lines, so he had a very tiny part, and he made such an impact with this sweeping the floor or whatever he did, and the expression on his face, and that it was really noticed and it was picked up on.
He actually stole the scene. And then he went into radio plays. Dr. Faustus was one of the first things he did, because he had that wonderful voice, didn't he? That just had so much in it. And for you, I mean, everybody's seen a Richard Burton film. For me, when I was young, when I first came to Richard Burton, he was just the best actor. For you, Under Milk Wood was important. Is that because Dylan Thomas, who he met at Oxford, was an important figure in terms of your interest in life? Why was that?
I just think Under Milk Wood is an amazing piece of work. And I have Dylan Thomas fascinates me. Should have been called Dylan, really, but he chose to be called Dylan because he didn't want to be called Dylan at school, which is an interesting point. And I just think that Richard did that narrator's part so brilliantly. I could listen to it again and again. I do go back to it, actually. So it is one of my favourites. And it's so, so very Welsh. It's just...
Obviously, his skills, he went into the Royal Air Force, and he used all of that, didn't he, in his army personas and his war films, because he had that experience in the Royal Air Force. And then Oxford. Short time in Oxford, yeah. Did you actually get to meet people like Dylan Thomas or some of these film stars like Richard Harris and Michael Caine and things like that? Was that something that happened occasionally in your life?
Not so much, but my Auntie Hilda's house, this was the old Jenkins family home where my grandfather lived, actually, until he died. There were various actors, I'm just trying to remember the names of them. They used to go there. It wasn't unusual for famous people and colleagues and fellow actors of Uncle Rich to go there. Anthony Hopkins, actually, that's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
He used to go there quite a lot. Hilda's not alive now. There's just one brother left now, Graham, the youngest one, the one who whose mother died very soon after he was born. So Richard's little brother, he's the only one still alive.
And what were the moments that you remember particularly enjoyed sharing with him? Because, you know, he was a person who had a very interesting private life. He was a very literary person, someone who read widely. What kind of things did he read, and what were his politics, and what kind of things did you share with him?
It's an interesting question. He never really talked about politics. He talked about social class a lot. I can remember one of the things he used to talk about when we were in Rome, which is the only extended period I've ever spent with him. He always used to say that he had a lot of time for the working class and for the aristocracy, or at least for the very, not so much the wealthy, but I don't know, the people at the top. But he had no time for the middle classes, and he had no time for the sort of snobbishness that you find in the acting world quite a lot. He was very dismissive of that. But he was very loyal to his working class roots. And I don't think I ever heard him describe himself as a socialist, but I certainly think his politics would have been more to the left than the right. But I don't think he was ever very active politically. actually. Mm-hmm. But he certainly had things he cared about. Mm-hmm. He cared about the family very much.
He was a man of letters as well, wasn't he? Because in the book you have lots of his letters, correspondence with his family. Someone who writes nice letters, kept in touch with his family. He was very keen on looking after them as much as possible.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. I mean, on the other side, that obviously he had huge amounts of money to spend on people, which is always nice, but he made lots of visits back to Wales, didn't he?
He did, yes. Yeah. He came back whenever he could.
What kind of impact did the ups and downs of his public life have on you as a family there? I mean, was it...
Well, when Elizabeth first appeared on the scene, a lot of the family were very, very upset, particularly my Uncle Ivor, who worked very closely with him and travelled with him and lived with him. And he and his wife got very close to Sybil. And it was quite a long time ago, you know, in those days, divorce and marriage breakup wasn't as common, nowhere near as common as it is now. So people, I think, the family at first thought this will blow over, it won't last, he'll go back to Sybil. And obviously my auntie Sybil was absolutely distraught. She had two little girls, one of them was quite seriously disturbed, and it was dreadful. But then very quickly it became apparent that this relationship with Elizabeth wasn't just going to go away. It was there to stay. And Elizabeth was very much accepted in the family, more so than perhaps...
She was someone who, I mean, the electricity and of the two people together was just plain for everybody to see
in
their tits and toga movies. In obviously Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, just showed what their relationship was like. But it must have been terribly hard on Sybil, his first wife.
It was awful for her.
And did you ever go to their boat?
There was a plan when I was in my 20s to go to Mexico. And because I was planning to spend a year in Spanish America, and the jumping off point for that year was going to be, actually it was Elizabeth's house in Mexico, but I remember getting a telegram which completely changed our plans for the year, because their marriage was going through a difficult patch. So the secretary said, I don't think it's a very good idea at the moment for you to go to Richard and Elizabeth's house, especially as it's more Elizabeth's house, and it's not a good moment in their relationship, so we didn't go. That was a shame.
When he was with his Welsh community, I mean, what was it like being in this Welsh village when the superstar kind of arrived? Was your status sort of changed as a family in the local community? Well, and then he did crazy things, didn't he? Like joining in a rugby game completely uninsured when he shouldn't have been. And
sure he did all sorts of outrageous things. Don't forget that there were only a few, actually it was one part of the family, it's a very, very big family, that continued to live in Pontrhydyfed. Most of us lived all over the place, not even always in Wales.
Yeah.
We actually lived in a village near Swansea, so he used to come there. So my biggest memory of Uncle Rich visiting is coming to our house, in Pontrhydyfed. Obviously he went there as well, but I don't think I was ever in Pontrhydyfed when he was there. But I do have a strong memory of him coming to see us, and all the neighbours being very interested, and people coming in and want, especially when Elizabeth was around, and wanting to sit in the chair that she had sat in. So all that kind of thing.
Because that's a crazy world, isn't it? The sort of paparazzi and the behaviour of ordinary people when they encounter that sort of... There's a massive contrast, isn't there, between Tinseltown and family life. Can that become quite irritating at times, or did you just enjoy the fame that went with all of that?
It didn't really touch us all that much. Mm. We noticed it obviously in Rome, because whenever we went around with them in Rome, he was recognised. I mean, this was at the height of their fame. The big scandal had passed. It wasn't the time of Cleopatra. It was after that. It was a few years later. So they were they were married, they were accepted as a couple. But yes, we were spotted everywhere we went. And my memory of that is that everybody wanted to give them presents. So we'd go into a shop and they wanted to buy us clothes or something, or, you know, swimsuits or something, and then the shop owners would say, oh, you can have it, you know, you don't have to pay for anything, you can have it free. I just found this quite amazing. So that sort of thing went on. We did encounter some of the rather petty squabbles that they used to have. There were wonderful moments and wonderful times around the table where Richard would tell stories and I would be absolutely entranced. But there was also some pettiness and some... And that was a bit sad, I think.
Now, your father, David Jenkins, what was he like as an older brother to have this... this brother who just brought so much...
he was very proud. But don't forget, there were lots of older brothers, because Richard was the second younger. Yeah. So he had lots of older brothers around. And I'm sure that in the early days when the whole possibility of them Richard and Elizabeth breaking up happened, then he had a few pep talks from the older brothers and the older sisters. You really shouldn't be doing this. Think of your family. But... yeah, it wasn't long before he managed to convince them that this was going to happen. So I think the overwhelming feeling was one of pride, real pride. And the absolute shock when he died so suddenly at 58. I remember the moment, because I was on holiday with my father at the time. We were in a Pembrokeshire holiday resort. And the news came from my Uncle Verdon. There was a phone call from Uncle Verdon. And my dad was absolutely devastated. Totally devastated. He could hardly believe it.
It was a very turbulent life all the way through, wasn't it? So much happened in his life,
And we haven't actually talked about the drinking and the depression.
Yeah. Well, that's the last part of your book deals with what happened to the rather somber last chapter in his life. What was all that like, basically, the drinking and the depression?
Well, my direct link with the drinking was in Rome. Actually, he wasn't, to be fair to him, he wasn't drinking particularly heavily then. There were times when he was, actually, and it definitely affected his mood, and that was when he would get very petty and do crazy things. Like my friend, I had a 16-year-old friend who was staying there with me. I mean, this is not the end of his life, but this scene was set quite a bit earlier, because he would do things like ask his driver to race Elizabeth's car home, that kind of silly thing. But yes, he did get quite high. He was quite busy towards the very end. He had done Private Lives, Noel Coward's Private Lives, he had done with Elizabeth in New York. And he also made 1984, very close to the end of his life. That was the year in which he died, 1984. So I think he would have gone on to do more things, but he hadn't conquered the drink problem. And I think the depression was very... The periods of depression were very closely linked with that.
Two moments, perhaps you can give me your favourite private moment with Richard and your favourite screen moment. What would you say they would be?
Oh gosh, I actually liked, even though there were lots of problems with it and he was too old for the part, I liked Look Back in Anger, which is one of the early films that he made. So I suppose one of my favourite screen moments would be that moments in that film. Even though I can see that there were lots of problems and he probably was too old for the part. And then Virginia Woolf is the other film that made a huge impact on me. And it was also a very good replica of what was going on. There was such close parallels with what was going on in his marriage to Elizabeth. So it was very alive, painfully so. Privately, I think it would have been those times over meals in Rome when he would just tell stories. I wish I could recall one of them, but I just have a great memory of his just being very relaxed, total opposite of the way he was in that interview, which I found so painful to watch with Parkinson. Because when he was relaxed, he could just hold the floor, and it was quite magical. And I remember thinking when I was 16, I was slightly in love with him, you know, because... he was somebody to be proud of, despite all the painful moments and the depressions and the drinking and the heartbreak. He was somebody to be very proud of.
Well, Sue Rogers, thank you for sharing such a wonderful story with me.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
German artist Günther von Hagen shocked the world when he exhibited real human bodies covered with lacquer in his exhibition space Body Worlds. Well, if you're passing 10 Green Street, try checking out A Skull Covered with Strips of Serrano Ham in the Window, which plays with the same unnerving theme, to try and draw your interest in. It's the work of artist Ian Walter, a second-year student at Cambridge School of Art, who's exhibiting with Changing Spaces. Inside, you'll find a row of shoulder-high plinths that each have a different bust-like head on a metal spring that move engagingly when you tread on the carpet. Ian, who gave up a successful business career to develop his art, is concerned with political art installations. Ian, what we've got here is an extremely interesting structure. It looks like, I mean, it's an interactive thing, a kind of star chamber of establishment judges' heads or something like that. What's the idea behind this?
It's almost the exact opposite of that.
Oh, is it?
So my start point was the fact that when you see bronze heads in public, they are invariably men. Hmm. They're named, and they're named for their status and their achievements. But if you see women, they're almost always anonymous, nude, whole-bodied. Hmm. So there's a definite gender divide.
Yeah.
So what I've done with this is I've taken four men who could be judges, but they're anonymous, and I've taken the bronze out, yeah. So they're just made of resin. And then they're mounted on springs, so they're slightly comical. Yes.
And also, they've each got a plinth, a white plinth pillar, and how did you make these heads? Because they look as though they're made of some kind of plastic or rubber. First of all,
resin.
A resin.
So
yeah.
the heads I've modelled from life.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've had I've cajoled friends into sitting for me for 3 hours a time for five times, and I model their head life size in clay, and then it's cast in resin. So I can then produce as many of them as I want to.
And now these wonderful heads, because they look wonderfully kind of like middle-aged men leaning forward on
and
the
nodding.
Springs. But there's also, I've got something underneath the carpet here that makes them move. What's that exactly?
So there's a red carpet, which is really inspired by the room. This is a beautifully wood-panelled room. Yeah. So it looks rather like a gentleman's club or a boardroom.
Yeah.
So I thought a red carpet dissecting the room. But underneath it are pressure pads, which rock the plinths only by a couple of degrees, but that's enough to set the heads off nodding, which is just comical. It makes people smile.
It makes you wonder what it is that they're trying to observe as well, doesn't it? I mean, they could be observing a small child or a phenomenon of some sort.
Oh, yes, or this one on the end is craning his neck to see perhaps what the others are doing.
Yeah. And you've got two on one side are in a kind of olive green colour, and the other two in a kind of yellow orange sort of, what would you call that, alabaster marble sort of colour.
Yeah, that's a good description of it.
Yeah.
And that was a complete accident, just that different manufacturers make resins that are slightly different colour. You hardly ever see raw resin like this. You normally see it with a stone powder in it or a bronze powder, whereas this is just the raw resin. And when I took these out, I was really surprised that they were different colours. But then I thought, actually, I quite like it because it makes you wonder if there's a hierarchy or a different age or... Yeah, I like the nebulous nature of it.
Is this recent work? Did you do it particularly for this exhibition, or is this something?
Yeah, it's constructed here.
So you looked at the room first, did you?
Before
you did it? Yes. What a super idea!
Yeah, and this beautiful panelled room just cries out for this sort of an installation. And Changing Spaces, who've provided it, had given us this space for 3 weeks as a project space to build work within, which is an amazing opportunity.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much indeed for sharing that with me.
Thank you.
Super thing to drop in. It's number 10 Green Street, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, 10 Green Street. If you're passing 10 Green Street, which used to be the old music shop, then take a peek through. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
Thank you.
Michael Owen, also a student with Cambridge School of Art, is exhibiting upstairs. His work looks at visual tricks playing on the contents of a room. You've got some really interesting stuff here, these sort of symbols that look perhaps a little bit like the symbols you get on ESP cards or something like that. Is that where the idea originated from?
Not at all, really. It was kind of, I was interested in the fragmentation of shapes originally, it was a couple of years ago now, and the fragmentation of imagery in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then that eventually I became overwhelmed with colour and vibrant gestural mark making. Mm-hmm. And then to question my own practice, I then minimalised that down to the kind of work you're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you hoping people are going to notice when they come in and look at this? If you can describe the works are basically, those are canvases with, what would you call it, white...
Primer?
White primer, and then interesting shapes just in black and white on them. How does the idea sort of develop through the... the work?
Well, the work is direct response to the room that it's placed in. Yeah. The canvases are placed on pallets that I made from and reduced down from bigger pallets. Yeah, the idea is it's exploring and just relating to the space directly, because it's quite a unique space with the grand fireplace there. Yeah. If I placed canvases just around the room, they wouldn't have related well to the fireplace, and the fireplace would end up being more of a distraction mm-hmm. than anything else. Mm-hmm. So, and originally, the one with the triangle, the main influence was how far could I push the boundaries in lazy art, in a way, I suppose.
Yeah.
To only prime a canvas where you're going to paint on it, and then where you paint on it, not even to finish the triangle, the shape that you want to put on it.
So. Yeah. So you're looking, I mean, the room is one of these wonderful Cambridge rooms that is not geometrically yeah. square in any way.
It's almost
hexagonal, and you've got these palettes and things and gaps, recesses with wood shapes around it. Basically, you're reflecting the physical environment into the art, basically,
yes,
to create
exactly.
a combined effect of the two things, which gives you a different space, doesn't it, altogether?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. No, it's definitely... I wanted the work, you know, because I did have... Originally, I included several paintings in this space along with these works, but I wanted the viewer to come in and then be immersed in the room as an entire piece. And when they looked at, I mean, I put a painting on that on the far wall, and it was just a painting. So when someone looked at it, they were then back in a gallery, as opposed to being in the space and enjoying the relationship between the work and the room.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
Every now and again, when you're leafing through a top-notch glossy magazine or reading an international Broad Street paper, you find a once-in-a-decade photograph that really captures a famous person in a rare moment in time when their guard is down and they're just being themselves in their own world. Taking truly iconic shots that encapsulate a celebrity's current life story isn't easy, and very few photographers can do it well. I've been talking to renowned Polish photographer Bolesław Lutosławski on the art of portraiture with celebrities, with which he made a name for himself in the international media by photographing Europe's most prominent arts figures. Bo grew up behind the Iron Curtain in Krakow, Poland, where he studied at Lodz Film School, and he later moved to the UK after a highly successful photography exhibition in London in 1980. Now he regularly gives talks on photography and lectures on modern art in Cambridge as an art historian. He says the successful people he's met in a tough and unforgiving world share a key in common: the ability to observe, listen, stay truthful, be honest, be instinctive, and above all, be fearlessly creative. What have you been doing in the past, and what brought you to Cambridge?
Well, I was born in Poland, and I studied in film college and art history as well. Mm. But throughout this time, I worked as a photographer. Mm-hmm. And in my mid-20s, I started to travel to the West, which wasn't so easy because it was Eastern Bloc country. But then I did go on trips, and I learned a lot about Europe and culture, and it was a wonderful experience, and then I stayed.
And you became a photographer after leaving, basically at Lodz University Film School, wasn't it,
yes.
originally?
Yeah.
What were your experiences in photography behind the Iron Curtain, when such things were perhaps a little bit verboten, as it were?
But because I was involved with portraits, it didn't matter. Authorities in Poland, in Eastern Bloc country, in Poland especially, they didn't care for arts, if you like. Arts was, you know, it's irrelevant. They felt safe with arts. So because I worked with artists and dancers and operas, it didn't matter.
You went on, obviously, to do, your photographs have been used in very famous publications like Newsweek, The Independent, Vogue, and Harper and Queen. So when were you first picked up as a photographer that people sort of recognised and thought, well, you know, these are photographs we really must have? When did that point come in your career?
Well, I came to London and I stayed at that time. It was 1980 to show about 100 of my portraits in London. So this was a starting point, and then I met other people. It's sort of like the word spread.
I just witnessed a talk that you gave the other evening called The Power of Our Minds, which was a very interesting photographic journey through your work, which basically had the thread of the talk that you gave was about people who fulfill their personal dreams. And what brought you round to giving talks of that sort?
It wasn't a long time ago that I realize that they are the hardest ones to work with because they are so open and fulfilled. So it's almost like they have no need. When we are stressed, if you like, it's more intriguing. And if somebody is so laid back and calm and achieved everything, yes, I'm here in front of them. Yeah.
You photographed some very famous people, among them Tom Stoppard, Simon Callow, Glenda Jackson, John Peel, and even George Martin. And you always you have a sort of system for doing that, don't you? Because you go in and you meet these people and you do a sitting with them. How long does the sitting take before you actually start doing the photography?
It tends to be quite quick. All those names, apart of one, were extremely open and gentle. So it wasn't even any need to get to know them, so to speak. In some cases, I didn't have much time anyway. With Glenda Jackson, it was about 20 minutes. And John Peel, maybe half an hour. So but it's a good length of time. I like it.
And what goes through your mind when you've got Tom Stoppard in front of you and you've only got a short amount of time? You've got to pick something up. What do you do?
It's instinctive. I know that I want to create a portrait which is true to him. And it's almost like meet somebody for the first time and you know it's amazing and it's intense. You don't actually think much about it. You rather go by your instinct. And a lot of it is obvious. Essentially, you have to stay in charge. You have to give an aura of authority, but also aura of softness. And I always feel that I want to show them great respect, but it doesn't mean they can do what they want. They have to know that they have to do what I tell them to do. So in a sense, I put them in a situations which are unexpected. So they react in an unexpected way for themselves, which means they open up. It was a charming situation with John Peel when I met him. And I met him in a tiny office in BBC. I've met him for the first time and the only time. And he put a record on. And I said, I switched it off. I took it off and I said, I want to work in silence. And he said, but it's my program for tonight. And I said, well, tough. But it's not that I was aggressive. I just made that change in his environment for this time. And so he had to pay attention to my... To myself.
These are people in a broad spectrum of disciplines. Obviously, one of the great images you had was of Glenda Jackson at the point where she is, was just basically leaving her acting career and going into politics. And you caught her at that moment when basically she was reinventing herself, which was a big change in her career. And you kind of got a very iconic photograph there. But also, there was one of her Polish distant. Who was that? Reading
Sławomir Mrożek. Playwright.
Reading a copy of George Orwell's 1984, and somehow you managed to get the flavour of that across in your photographs. I don't know how you do that. That's your gift, though, isn't it? To communicate the whole person with a moment in time, which is absolutely great.
It wasn't posed. It wasn't planned. He just read that book at that time. That's how it was.
But now, most of this work that we've been talking about is available in books which you published as well.
Yeah.
One of them is called Portrait Photographer, and that has a stupendously good photograph of your wife on the front, doesn't it?
Yes.
Whose name is Grazna, is
it? Grazna, yes.
Which is a really fabulous book. But you've also brought another one in here for me to have a look at. What's this book about?
This on the same sort of subject, but it's in Polish. This one is called Alchemia Portretu, which is Alchemy of Portraiture. And it was extraordinary because a lady on the front is a portrait of a lady who is called Bem Lahand, and she studied here in Cambridge, and I took it when she was, I think, 19. Then we lost touch. Then we met once again in Cambridge because she came here again for a couple of days. And then she went to live in Australia. She writes books, amazing books. And we lost touch, and I wanted to use it on the front. It was like even when the book was they worked on the book in Poland, they said, oh, maybe we'll use another portrait. And I said, no, you're not going to use another portrait. Well, we thought about it, and I said, no. So they used this one. And then the book came out in June, and probably 3 weeks later, I got emailed from her, from Bem Lahand, that she was in Warsaw, walked on the street and saw the book in a bookshop on the cover. And I said, I bought the book, but it was incredible to see myself. So it was a wonderful experience, and we're back in touch.
Bo Lutosławski, thank you very much indeed for coming in. The work speaks for itself. I can recommend it to anyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Cambridge's profile as an international art destination was significantly boosted this month. 16 breathtaking art installations using cutting-edge light technology lit up public spaces and landmarks in the city centre. The Illuminate Festival of Light, in its second year, has also featured music concerts, magic shows and workshops, and has doubled in size and popularity. The recent appointment of Deepak Misri as an expert in collaborations between art and business as executive director, and Juliet Bowmaker as artist liaison officer, signify that it's now become an annual fixture and has attracted prestigious new sponsors, including Grand Arcade, Panasonic, John Lewis Partnership and Cambridge Bid. Founder Alessandra Caggiano and Chairman Hugh Purnell presented an event launch to the sound of violinist Aligia Smetana.
I am incredibly pleased about the response that we've got in the last 12 months. It's been amazing, and I really hope it's going to keep growing this rate, really.
During your speech, you talked about making Cambridge an international art destination. That's a really big idea that a lot of people share. How do you envisage your particular plank in that is working?
We want to keep working with artists, not just local artists, but also get more international artists involved in what we do here in Cambridge and really showcase what is great here.
Take me through some of the things that people are going to see tonight on the tour they're about to set off on.
Okay, then one of the what's amazing things is going to be the King's Parade show. That's thanks to Susie Oaksa and Pulsar Lighting, all coordinated by Anagram Production, and it's color changing pattern onto the King's Wilkins screen. So that's pretty spectacular. And something else happening is the Guildhall will see a giant game of Knots and Crosses, and the audience can interact with the building. Also, we have color-changing clock here on the John Lewis window on the Downing Street side. And we have on the facade of the Grand Arcade a projection mapping show.
Okay, those are things that people can immediately sort of engage with. But what's clever about the technology behind those things?
Well, it's all about eco-efficiency. So the majority of technology involved is really, in the spaces we're talking about, low-carbon innovation. And most of it is actually invented here in Cambridge.
There are three things that we're mashing together. There is the artistic creative, there is the low carbon technology innovation, and there's the whole business about energy efficiency. And eventually people will come to understand that we can't afford to have all these lights on, and that we are going to understand about energy efficiency. And what we're trying to do subtly is, by using creativity and by using innovation, put people into a place where they think a little bit more carefully about lighting as one of the things that we absorb a lot of energy with. So the creative and the innovative with a low carbon message is a really important and indeed probably unique way of trying to represent light in this context.
And how do you feel that the local artists have actually responded to the whole idea?
They responded very well, not just the technology itself, but also to the locations. This is really what made the festival so special.
What a fantastic launch event. Thank you both very much indeed. Bill Munday attracted attention as a man wearing a spectacular light tech bow tie made from electronic circuit boards and flashing lights to draw people into his new networking tool.
We're in the what's known as the interactive events business, and what we do is we have these special badges. People have these badges at an event, and when they tap with each other, they can exchange their contact details. And it's really simple, and people love it. We've created a new social interaction, which is the ice-breaking interaction, and you know, people are getting more and more addicted to it.
It's networking at lightning speed.
Absolutely.
Just to describe them, they're lovely, smooth, and plastic and name cards.
That's right.
And all you have to do is just touch and that's it, you've got it.
Yeah, you have to do a little bit of a tap, and that tap makes sure that it works. You get a light and a buzz afterwards, means that you've done it and you've connected with somebody.
How important is it to see light technology being given something of a forum in Cambridge?
Light adds so many different angles to everything, and light illuminates things, and because of the way the eye perceives everything, you sort of get a whole different perception of what objects are. And I think what Cambridge is doing here at Illuminate is fantastic.
Cambridge Beard, a new organisation designed to oil the wheels of commerce in the city by assisting with PR, marketing and business support, is a sponsor and supplied bowler-hatted city ambassadors to guide people to the attractions. Here's spokesman Edward Quigley.
One of the first words that you hear associated with Cambridge is innovation. Mm-hmm. It's always what you hear, whether it's the science, it's biomed, it's the technology. I think there's a lot of innovation in Cambridge. I think that it goes beyond the traditional sectors. I think that our retail and independents are innovative in the way they approach their business. We have a thriving city centre. In fact, there's been a information recently that's confirmed that Cambridge has the lowest amount of vacancies in terms of shops in the country. So there's a lot of positives about Cambridge. The bid is about supporting those and reinforcing them. We've achieved a lot, but there's a hell of a lot more to come.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
If you're venturing down Norfolk Street later today and fancy a bit of an adventure, you might drop into Changing Spaces Gallery to meet painter Peter Hawksby and view his latest set of paintings on his exhibition's last day. He's best known locally for his charcoal drawings of rock pools in Cornwall, which recently exhibited at Williams Art. But this time he's been working with oils and acrylics on canvas, and he takes us on a journey through confined spaces in some 20 works, working with the loose theme of exploration inside a pyramid and discovering a series of secret chambers, with which he takes us on a journey towards abstraction. Peter studied at the Hull College of Art and later at the Slade.
In this current exhibition, you're working on paper with canvas using oils and acrylics. Can you tell me how this exhibition came about?
It goes right back to 1967 when I first went to Hull. And my first sort of conscious stab at achieving a style obviously was based on a current fashion of art, which at that time people like Robin Denny, John Hoyland and the American abstract expressionists were all vogue. And I liked their work, so I just jumped into that. So it does start a long time ago. As a way of working purely flat field colour imagery, it comes and goes over my sort of life for the last 40 years, interspersed with other preoccupations, really. Mm-hmm. Until about 4 or 5 years ago, I had spent nearly 15 years working only in black and white, on canvas, and all the work was based on studies of rocks and water from sketches done in Cornwall. Mm-hmm. And that came to a sort of natural pause, and I decided I would go back to exploring colour. Mm-hmm. And this, as a vehicle for that, was just what I needed, again, flat field. Going right back to the degree course, I chose to write my thesis on Vermeer, as the master of the Dutch genre painting that I admired the most for his work in tight spaces and the classical sort of stillness, but nevertheless very measured spaces that he constructed. I always just loved his work. So it's that same preoccupation. The rock pools, okay, the types of rock pools I did go for are enclosed spaces, but the actual approach is much more calligraphic and gestural mark-based, because that isn't what happens here.
To do the rock pools, those are drawings using charcoal, aren't they?
Oh. What happens is I go to Cornwall and I will do sketchbooks with pencil, charcoal, whatever, on the spot. Trouble is, my eyes water, I'm standing there wiping, I'm getting wet and I'm drawing. And even the roughest little scribble, I will go back to a studio and I will rebuild it in charcoal, usually, and then take it onto probably canvas with brush and paint.
What fascinates you about rock pools, because you've done so many of them?
Well, the funny thing about a rock pool is, what shape is a rock? And they are naturally abstract to me, but they are full of energy and this counterpoint of movements, so the water movements and the rock structures, which obviously affect each other. That obviously is plenty to get your teeth into, and I never found that there was a lack of variety, because I always go back to the same sort of place on the south coast, and it's infinite.
Now, the theme behind this exhibition is basically enclosed, a sort of an exploration for enclosed spaces, which is tied into your notions about what it might be like to be inside a pyramid.
This particular batch, last August, I dug out some old sketchbooks and rediscovered drawings I had done at the Slade in 1970-71. I had bought a book about the structure of the pyramids, which fascinated me, and did some sort of pieces for environments at the Slade based on them. But there they were in this sketchbook, and I still responded to this feeling of tight spaces, corridors, light coming around corners, the mass of weight that you can't see but feel.
And they're previously unseen or secret spaces as well.
That sort of thing, yes. Yeah. That's just an excuse to get started, but it was enough. Mm. And I started working on single, smaller sheets of paper. I did explain, I think the other day, that they were all single horizontal sheets. I did 20 or 30 of these and chose earthy colours in browns and greys.
Yeah.
And then after looking at them, thinking, well, I've done something rather obvious here, same old stuff comes out. Then I turned them all vertically. I thought, oh, I like that much better. Mm. And then I started pairing them off and creating a narrative between the two halves, which opens up so many more possibilities for carrying on with the images.
Are you interested in the palette of ancient Egypt? Because there was something like, in the tomb paintings, in the pyramids and things like that, that they only used about 25 specific colours to create all of the artwork that went in there. And are those colours of interest to you or not?
Yes, they are, because they are, first of all, natural earth-based or dye-based vegetable pigments, mostly, I would think, or mineral-based pigments. As for 25, I didn't realise there were that many, but I rarely get past half a dozen, which is all I can cope with. But yes, like I said, the early ones were deliberately earthy colours, with the odd bright colour to try and, you know, kick it off, so to speak, which people have responded. You yourself and other people who visited this said they recognise these as being the feeling of Egyptian, which wasn't my intention, but I'm pleased about. You can link things that aren't physically linked, but your eye will jump from one to the other. So it does take you on a journey through looking at the paintings. So it's a very good vehicle for that. And yes, it's a sort of journey towards an abstraction. And then hopefully, if I've done it well enough, it clicks back together as a single object. So you the tension created between the two methods of looking at it are what I find exciting to explore.
Each image leads to the next one.
You know.
Peter Hawkesbury, thank you for a most interesting visit to your gallery.
Well, thank you very much. It was a very nice surprise when you came in yesterday.
It's time to take a look at what's coming up in the city in the next couple of weeks. If you're listening to the rerun of this programme, much of this will be out of date. On Saturday the 1st of March, comedy group Gob Squad present Western Society at the Cambridge Junction, a chance to see the whole of human history condensed into just 10 minutes and a colourful portrait of the world we live in. Currently running at Wising Arts in Bourne, the Annals of the 29th Century is a group exhibition of new commissions as part of the Artists in Residence programme, marking a 25th anniversary. Pygmalion by George Bernard Shaw opens at the Arts Theatre on Wednesday the 25th of February, starring Alistair McGowan as Henry Higgins. John Harle and Mark Almond in The Tyburn Tree take to the stage in the Corn Exchange on March the 4th to deliver an epic song cycle looking at London's dark and terrible past. Jack the Ripper and poet William Blake feature. And that's all from Arts Roundup this week. If you have a creative story to tell, please send me an email at simon@cambridge105.fm. And I hope you've enjoyed tuning into the Art Dimension on Cambridge 105 Community Radio.